Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins. Coming up on today's show, Jordan Yule, the host of Deep Dive on the Young Turks, co-host of the Insurgents podcast, is going to be here to tell us how an entire generation might be being priced out of the housing market, all thanks to corporate greed. We'll also be talking about Matt Gaetz's wild week, where not only did he try to body shame a teenager, a stunt that backfired on him tremendously, but he was also one of 20 Republicans who voted against legislation that would have cracked down on human trafficking. Big question mark, right, as to why Matt Gaetz wouldn't want that becoming a law. We'll also be talking about the Department of Justice officially letting us know that they are, in fact, looking at Donald Trump as part of their grand jury probe. And we'll talk about the plan from Donald Trump's allies to stack the government with up to 50,000 of his loyalists to serve as yes men and yes women if he retakes the White House in 2024. All that and more is coming up. And don't forget, if you want to get the full Ring of Fire podcast every single week, you can go and sign up to become a member at rofpodcast.com. You can also get Ring of Fire every single day of the week on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. So to kick things off this week, I do want to take a moment to give an update about a story that we talked about last week in my interview with Bobby Lewis from Media Matters. Now, in that interview, we had mentioned that it was possible and very likely, of course, that Verizon Fios was about to drop the One America News Network. Shortly after that interview was recorded, and I do mean within hours of that interview being recorded, Verizon made it official and said, yes, at the end of this month, we are dropping the One America News Network. They said that they could not come to an agreement with the network, and therefore, they're gone. Which, of course, as we pointed out last week, leaves One America on one linear network, if you want to call it a network. It is a local cable provider up in Alaska that reaches maybe about 100,000 people. So at best, One America might get a couple thousand viewers a day from that cable station up in Alaska. So effectively, they're screwed. That's the big takeaway of all of this. One America, which is probably the worst of the worst in conservative media, and of course that is saying a whole heck of a lot, but they serve as a MAGA propaganda outlet. That's what they are. They go out there, they send these hosts out there, people like Alison Steinberg, who, if you're on Twitter, you've probably seen people sharing video clips of her ridiculously immature and vile rants that she puts out. And that's what they pass off as news. But I did find it very interesting this week because after it was official that Verizon was dropping, then Alison Steinberg did a segment, which of course then got shared all over social media, where she was begging liberals, begging them to join their cause and help save One America. You know, the same people that she and the rest of the hosts on the network literally demonize every single day, she's now saying, please come to our rescue because we need you, because she says, you'll be next. Oh, these big corporate censors are going to somehow come after you. Well, rational people understand that that is in fact not happening. You know, we're not at risk of big tech censors really coming after us. That's not a thing. It's a thing, by the way, that Republicans have of course been talking about for years, but it's not actually a real thing. Conservative voices, not just on traditional media, linear media, but also in new media, in online media, in social media, conservative voices dominate liberals every day. They have more channels, they have more reach, they get more exposure. Conservatives are beating liberals left and right in that arena, and it's very unfortunate, obviously, but that doesn't mean that liberals are necessarily being censored. One America lost its providers, DirecTV, Verizon, Fios, because the network is trash. And what do you have to do when the trash piles up and becomes too much? You take it out. You take out that trash, which is exactly what Verizon and DirecTV have done. They looked at this stinking pile of garbage and they said, by God, I think it's time we take that out. Let's get rid of the garbage. It's stinking up the place. And so they made their decisions based on that. One America, of course, is also facing 1.3 or 1.6. I can't remember, off the top of my head which one they're facing. But anyway, they're facing at least $1.3 billion worth of defamation lawsuits from voting companies. And seeing as how they're no longer on any real carrier that can give them advertising dollars, I don't think they walk away from this. My prediction, and I've made this on my YouTube channels, and I'm going to make it here on the podcast as well to make sure it reaches as many people as possible. My prediction, by the end of this year, 2022, the One America News Network, as we know it, will cease to exist. And even though there's still countless other conservative media outlets out there, if one of them goes away, we at least have to count that as a victory. It's not going to silence conservatives. It's not going to change the narrative. It's not even going to shift thinking here in the United States, probably. But it's going to take a little bit of hate off of the airwaves, and that is always a good thing. The housing market here in the United States continues to get worse month after month after month. And at this point, it has essentially, thanks to all of this private equity getting into the housing market, it's priced an entire generation, if not more, completely out of the housing market. Joining me to talk about this right now, I have Jordan Yuhl, who is by far one of the best folks on Twitter, but he's also the host of Deep Dive on the Young Turks, and he is the co-host of the Insurgents podcast. Jordan, it is a pleasure to have you here on Ring of Fire with us. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you've got a piece that came out this week in Newsweek where you talked about the fact that you, as a millennial, you are seeing a housing market that has essentially left you and millions of others completely behind. And this is a problem like the likes of which we haven't seen really in this country, with as bad as things are getting in the housing market at such a rapid rate too. That's what's so terrifying, is that this wasn't, a slow, gradual 20, 30 years. No, we've seen so much horror in 2 years here. It's unimaginable. So take us through, what you found here.
That's right. I think the problem that we're seeing, beyond just an inflated cost of living that's making things really difficult for working people, is that the investor class is gobbling up millions of homes. So last year, around 25% of all single family homes that were sold were bought by investors. And over 75% of those purchases were made in cash. And this piece highlights that dilemma and how it's led to increasingly rising rates of rent, how it's pricing people out of the market. But on a human level, I was overwhelmed with the number of people who reached out to me who are around my age, maybe a little bit older, a little bit younger, who said in their own experience, my wife and I, or my partner and I, just put in an offer for a house and we were outbid by an investment firm who paid in all cash. That's just totally imbalanced. And if you buy into the American dream, owning a home is a core component of that. It's a very simple thing, but it's one of the biggest generators of wealth for families. And when you're competing against groups like BlackRock and various Wall Street firms, you're outnumbered. There's no way you could match that buying power. So when you have stagnant wage increases for decades, when you're dealing with a rate of inflation that's historic, when you're dealing with higher gas prices, all of these things are eating into people's budgets at home. 75% of people say that inflation is outpacing their wage. People are relying on credit card debt. People are taking out loans just to make ends meet. And they aren't then able to save for a down payment for a home because of all these other economic factors. And if you are lucky enough, now you have to compete with Wall Street. And that's just totally unjust.
Right. I mean, we're up against individuals that have a seemingly unlimited supply of money. whereas the average home buyer clearly is on a finite budget. They know what they can afford. They know they have limits. And that's the difference. We going to buy a home have a limit. We can't do more than this. We only have this much saved up. We can't afford a payment above X amount. These other firms say, you know what? We've got extra cash laying around. Recently, headline out of Florida, where I am, a big investor group came in, spent $43 million, bought an entire community. Okay, not just little houses here and here. They bought an entire community of homes, the property, the pre-built homes, everything. And that's what's happening. And Florida, of course, is one of the worst hit states with the rent hikes, with the pricing, house price problem. We have seen it at levels, I think, last I saw, actually this morning, higher than the rest of the country. Not by a ton, but we're still, unfortunately, getting it the worst. But that doesn't mean that this isn't, you know, obviously a nationwide problem. So what, if anything, can we or is being done about this? I mean, we know the problem. We've talked about it. We've talked about it on Ring of Fire. I know other folks in progressive media are talking about it. So we all know the problem exists. What the hell is happening with it?
Very little's being done. The Congress is totally paralyzed. I'm shocked that we are even potentially seeing a deal with Manchin on reconciliation. Just that we have any action whatsoever out of Congress is surprising. So with the moneyed interests influencing enough politicians to stop anything that would benefit working people, I mean, I don't know what we could do theoretically, but like ideally rent control, you know, outlawing, you know, private equity from buying private homes in mass amounts. That's just, it seems like a no-brainer because working people, like you say, are never going to be able to match that buying power. On the rent thing, though, it's not just homeowners or aspiring homeowners who are being subject to this. Rents across the board are increasing. And a study from, I think it was Redfin a couple months ago, found the national median monthly payment for rent has exceeded $2,000 for the first time, which is exorbitant. And that was a 15% increase from the year prior. This was May. So it was 1,700 or so, which is still very, very high for a median. But that rate of increase was around 15% in a lot of major cities, with some up to 50%, like in cities like Austin. That is horrifying. How are people going to be able to suddenly afford 50% higher rates of rent when you aren't getting that kind of a wage increase? And there's a vast number of people in this country who are financially strained because they pay anywhere from 30 to 50% of their wages on rent. That's just totally unsustainable. And this profiteering on people, working people who aren't making enough, is really disgusting and disheartening. I don't think enough people in Congress are close enough to the issue or come from working class backgrounds and understand just how difficult that is, because a volatile downturn in this country, which it looks like we're on the precipice of, if we see a recession. I lived in Youngstown, Ohio during the financial crash of 2008, and I saw friends and family lose their homes. And that was a pretty dark time in my life and in the lives of so many around me. I really fear what comes next. If this is the path that we continue down with inflation high, the job losses that'll come from a recession, and ultimately people losing their homes or places to live as a result of high prices and, you know, no protections for the working class, it could get really bleak.
You know, so we're looking at a situation here where we have these investors, the equity firms, the hedge funds, the Wall Street types buying up all these homes and pricing people out of the market, which, to be honest, I don't even understand how that's a smart business practice. When you look at the statistics of what Americans are earning, what they can afford, and you're pricing your good out of their reach, I mean, first of all, how can you even hope to offload it when you know people cannot afford this? So the likely scenario here is that we end up with another housing market crash. You have all of these properties that are now essentially worthless for these investors. There's no way to recoup their money. So that also creates the big question mark of what the hell do they do then? You know, do you sit there and hold on to it as more and more people lose their homes and those become bank-owned properties with more things they can't offload? This is a disaster waiting to happen. It's a disaster they created, and I don't even know if they have the foresight to see what is coming down them at this point, barreling towards them full speed, and it's going to be a big crash. But hey, they'll probably get bailed out. We won't, but they will.
That's what I was going to say. I'm sure they understand the risks, but they know they could just get a bailout. It's happened before. It'll happen again. And whenever a big institution or a big sector of our economy struggles or plummets because of their own misdeeds or their own reckless investing, they have a bailout waiting for them. We never do. It's just so frustrating when you see all these different financial ploys, or when you see all these different maneuvers by Wall Street. Even just, you know, people take, like, to go back last year, this isn't a systemic issue, but I think it was a good indication of the governing financial mindset with the GameStop short sellers. People were upset that, you know, this firm had shorted this company and they were trying to kind of stick it to them. And that shorting a company is a notoriously risky position because you could be subject to unlimited losses because of that position. And you saw people working behind the scenes to make sure that that company that took that risky decision didn't really incur any financial losses through Citadel Capital and a few other institutions. But it's just like, it's a good indication and a reminder of just how rigged this system is. So companies can swoop in, buy millions of homes, price out millions of buyers or prospective first-time buyers from a housing market, which is something you actually need. You don't need GameStop stock, but you need a place to live. And the United States just doesn't recognize the right to having a home as a fundamental human right, which some places in the world do, and we should. But if the housing market collapses again, there'll be a bailout likely waiting for them.
Yeah, there's always money for a bailout anytime a corporation needs it, which is why, of course, it gets so confusing and frustrating when we're promised $2,000 checks 18 months ago and we get, you know, a fraction of that because, well, you already got your money. It's the same thing a parent tells a kid, like, I'll give you $20, and then they give them 10 and they say, well, I also bought your dinner at McDonald's, so, you know, that's the other 10 here. Like, no, you made a promise, give it to us. But then with corporations, they come with their hands out. They say, we made bad decisions. You know, we knew this could happen, sure, like they told Congress during the bailout hearings. Yeah, there were some warnings, but we did what we did. Okay, well, you've learned your lesson, right? Here's your big check. You guys go on now. Go play outside for a bit. And they don't learn because they don't get punished for any of this. And, you know, I told a story last week here, and I'll tell it again because it is so very relevant to this. The only reason I have the home that I have right now is because my wife and I, a newlywed couple, kid on the way, we needed a house because we couldn't just stay in my sister's condo that we were living in at the time. We couldn't afford anything in this area where we lived, the area where I worked, the area where she was trying to find a job. We were a one-income couple. Below $25,000 a year, we had nothing. We finally found a home that was a foreclosure, riddled with termite damage. I mean, walls falling apart, and that's all we could afford. So we got it. We still live there. We're still trying to fix it, even though it's been, you know, over a decade. But had it not been for the housing market crash that left this empty, vacant house on the market owned by a bank to get eaten by termites for over a year, we wouldn't have been able to buy a home back then and certainly could definitely not do it now. You know, we were looking a year or two ago. Let's get out of here. And we saw home prices. We said, well, we're stuck with termite house. Let's just continue replacing wall after wall. And it's a horrible situation. And I hate to think that may be the only situation where other millennials can even buy houses, is wait for a big crash, hope there's some foreclosures, hope it's not too dilapidated, and then maybe we can realize this part of the American dream. But I think that's the only way at this point.
Yeah, a story a friend was telling me the other night. She, a year ago, was riding her bike, got hit by a truck, and just a week or two ago got her settlement money from this person and his insurance company. And now she's like, the prospect of home ownership is only now in reach because she got hit by a truck. It's like, this should not be the type of circumstance that someone needs to be in to buy a home.
You know,
so bleak.
And I will add on to that, because I had been in a pretty nasty car wreck 2.5 years before we bought that house, and it was because of the settlement I got, which wasn't big, but it was enough to actually pay off my debts, at my credit card debts at the time, didn't touch my student loan debt, but I paid off those debts. That's how I was able to qualify for the loan. So similar situation, right? I had to get in a car accident. I had to buy a foreclosure. I had to deal with, you know, live termites for 2 years. They've all been killed now. We're just still replacing the damage. So if you make all of these three criteria, which I think was also in Kamala Harris's plan for student loan debt forgiveness, by the way, if you do all of these things that I have done, you can buy a house, folks. That's where we're at as a country. Like, you got to maim yourself. You got to make sure the whole economy is in the toilet. And then you get the American dream. If you can, you know, basically get struck by lightning 3 times in a row, you qualify at this point.
Right. I'm going to go start walking in the street, and then maybe I can get a house. But I'm glad you mentioned student loan debt, because that is one of the factors that's causing millennials to delay entering the housing market. You know, it would be probably several months to a year or two sooner if their debt was freed up. And, you know, there's tons of studies that show that they're delaying home ownership because they're burdened by student loan debt. And that's one thing. You talk about solutions. That's one thing we don't need Congress for. Biden could do that with the stroke of a pen. He could cancel all of it. He's already canceled millions. And he's doing this kind of like tinkering around the edges, patting themselves on the back. And you get these headlines like, oh, hundreds of millions canceled. Well, total student loan debt is almost $2 trillion. And it's bigger than credit card debt. So people really need to understand just how bad this debt burden is for students. And it's holding an entire generation, and now soon Gen Z, back. Freeing up that debt burden would give the like millions of people in the working class increased purchasing power, which would stimulate the economy, and many of them would buy their first home. It's a win-win. Like, why wouldn't we want this? And it's sad to see this being treated with caution, and Democrats governing from a position of fear on something they could do unilaterally without Congress. So we might see next month $10,000 in cancellation, and then punting on repayments until next year, and just kind of dangling it like a carrot in front of voters. I think people are not going to fall for it. They're frustrated. This is something you could do immediately, and he's just choosing not to.
And of course, it's going to be means tested. You know, we're going to have those income caps, which is absolutely stupid, because depending on where you live, that income cap, which is a 150 to 160. Okay. But if you're living in Manhattan, or if you're living in a big city and you're making $150,000 a year, you're not well off. I mean, increasingly in more and more of this country, if you make $150,000, you're not that well off. There should be no means testing across the board. If you make $10 million a year, you make $10 a year. We're paying off $10,000. We're going to keep it easy and simple. Cut out the bureaucracy. That's what we're going to do. And on those debts, a lot of them that he's already forgiven, it's only because these are the students that went to the total scam colleges. You got ripped off with a worthless degree. And then they finally said, okay, you cannot pay it back. Like, I went to school for 4 years for nothing. And now you're finally 10 years later saying, all right, we'll help you out a little. It's ridiculous, because there's been the groups, right? These activist groups that say, we've written the damn executive order for you. You just rewrite it. You know, type it out and sign it. We've done the work for you. By God, just do it. And he's just not doing it, is the only way to describe it. He simply says, no, I'm not going to do it right now. It's nuts.
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I don't know what to say. They just don't care. I think that's what's infuriating.
It is. And so, as you know, you had briefly mentioned the deal with Manchin, and we're getting all these, God love them, the blue no matter who folks saying, aha, good thing we didn't kick Joe Manchin out of the caucus. How dare you say we should have? No, this is a deal that could have been done 8 months ago had the Democrats behind the scenes said, listen, Joe, if you don't get your act together, you're out. We're going to strip you of your leadership. You're just going to be the Marjorie Taylor Greene of the Senate. You're going to be here, but you're not going to have any power. And we can do that, and we will do that if you don't fall in line. You know, they basically had to resort to this trickery of, you know, haha, we got you, Mitch McConnell, just to get a deal that's still very watered down. It's still going to do some not good things. Just to get one guy that represents 0.5% of the U.S. population to go along with it. Again, crazy what we're seeing out of D.C.
It is, but it's not a done deal. Just last night, I saw Bob Menendez from New Jersey come out with concerns about it because he says it's because the SALT deduction isn't included, which is the state and local tax deduction, which disproportionately benefits wealthy homeowners in big blue states. So he might not be a yes, but there's still cinema. Increasing the minimum or instituting a minimum corporate tax rate of 15%. I think I saw over 70 corporations paid below that in 2021 on billions and billions of total collective profits. That might be a no for her because she's been pretty vocal about opposing any corporate tax increases. Recently, a couple months ago, she spoke to the Arizona Chamber of Congress and said such to roaring applause. So she might be a no because of that. Menendez might be a no. He says it's the SALT deduction, but pharma is a huge industry in New Jersey. He's taken a ton of money from big pharma. He has routinely done their bidding. I could see him blocking it while framing it as a SALT thing, ultimately to benefit the pharmaceutical companies. So we still have two potential no's. And while it is like some of the climate investments are good, I mean, that this would be more than any country in the world has spent, it's still not enough, but it would make a big impact in reducing our emissions, which is good. And I think anything we can do is important, but it's not enough. And we still have two potential no's, which again, this is rotating villain theory, right? Manchin is now potentially a yes, but then we have now two people to worry about, just this cursed game of whack-a-mole.
What? That's probably the best way to put it. But listen, Jordan, thank you for talking with us. Tell everybody where they can find you, your social media, your podcast, your Substack. Let us have it.
Sure. I'm on Twitter at Jordan Yule. My Substack is I Hate It Here and Never Want to Leave. It's about these economic conditions that so many of us find ourselves in and why we remain in them, sometimes out of our own control. Because leaving this country, this state, our cities would sever ties with our family, our community around us. It's at hateithere.net. And my podcast is called The Insurgents. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Jordan Yule, thank you so much for talking with us today. It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for the free portion of this week's Ring of Fire podcast. But if you want the full show every single week, plus access to the entirety of the Ring of Fire podcast archives, go sign up and become a member at rofpodcast.com.